Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for June 16, 2022. I'm going to be talking about the years of 1986, 87 up to about 1991 and some the events that went on there. This was actually a time of very low science activity because all of the cometary probes were done. There were no more planetary probes. The space shuttle was basically inoperable for all practical purposes. So space really did not have much going on. There were no more planned manned missions. Just a lot of nothing going on. The only thing that is worth talking about is the Magellan probe, and I'll be talking about that, and that's at Venus. And just a little highlight there, the Magellan probe was an orbiter, and it was designed with a radio transmitter and receiver, and what it did is it mapped the surface of Venus, because you cannot optically see the surface of Venus because of the tremendous cloud cover, etc. So the surface of Venus was mapped by the Magellan spacecraft. And it took about a year to do the complete cycle, and the spacecraft was supposed to have that would be the end of its tour when it did a complete 100% mapping of the planet Venus. And it got done, but it still had some energy left, some batteries, whatever it needed. So they decided to go and do it again and continue remapping the surface of Venus. And what they found was that the surface of Venus had completely changed. It was nothing like what it was even a year before. And what they found is regions were bolstered up, other regions were dropped down, and so this is an active volcanic surface that is just absolutely molten and bubbling and oozing out sulfuric acid, etc. So the surface of Venus is constantly changing, certainly not a planetary surface that is 4.5 billion years old, as they claim. It's a brand new planet. It's only a few thousand years old. Now, this is culminating in around the year 1989. And also there was the culmination of a number of Mars missions. What was very clear about Mars is, number one, it had a surface that was very recently had water. And I have on my webpage, one of my subpages is called Pictures of the Day. In there, I have a very long session on the photographs of Mars. In fact, the centerpiece of my book, the weather book, Principia Meteorologia, is a series of high-resolution plates that are of the Martian surface. And very important, because what it shows is that Mars had a surface that is pockmarked, in other words, craters, impact craters in certain areas in the highlands. And Mars is somewhat like Earth. It's kind of egg-shaped. So there are highlands. If you took an average radius of Mars, you would find that there are areas of Mars which are higher than the average and areas that are lower than the average. So it's like something like Earth, where the lowlands are covered with oceans. And the same situation was with Mars. And what you see is all on the highlands, you see the rivers, many of them pristine little winding streams that were channeled by water. And so that this was an active water atmosphere. The great mountain Olympus Mons has the same shore structure as you would find on, say, Pacific Islands, where the windward side is eroded away with big cliffs, etc., and a lot of rain and channeling due to rivers and runoff. And then the leeward side is drier and is not as marketed. It's more like beaches where the water used to be. But you find that the lowlands have no cratering at all, which means that recently Mars had water, oceans of water, and it needed an atmosphere to hold that in place. And so I want to quote a recent article also about the wind storms on Mars. Now, the reason I'm doing this, because this is a recent article that just occurred, now where I'm recording this on June of 2022, and so that's telling you that from the 1980s up to 2022, there has been no progress in understanding the real situation on Mars. And so this new paper is talking about wind storms on Mars being caused by solar light, which is absolutely absurd. So what you have conditions on Mars, you have 300-mile-an-hour wind storms that would take the paint off your house in 2 seconds, dust storms. And they're trying to tell you that these dust storms are caused by an imbalance of solar radiation, that it somehow accumulates in the atmosphere and then all of a sudden explodes into these massive wind storms. Absolutely absurd. And of course, the wind storms are caused by electrical conditions, as on Earth, as on Jupiter. All of the winds are electrical. They're driven electrically. And that's the point I make in my book, Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. The very first thing I start with is the current theories that the sunlight somehow creates weather. And by the way, when you get out to Jupiter or Saturn, which has more extreme wind patterns than Jupiter, the sun looks like another star. It's just like maybe just a little bit bigger than average star in the sky. It has no light that really enters the planet, or the really a small star. Saturn has the most violent wind systems in the solar system. So it's, you know, the idea that somehow this is caused by sunlight is beyond absurd. But, of course, these people don't know that. I'm going to quick quote this article so you can see the one I'm talking about. It's called Solar Heat Likely the Primary Cause of Dust Storms on Mars. And this is, I get a journal's, this one happens to be called Mars Daily. And it's just a rag for a lot of advertisement and for rah-rah NASA, whatever NASA, etc. And so they're saying here that the study indicates, I'm reading from the article, this study indicates there are seasonal energy imbalances in the amount of solar energy absorbed and released by Mars, which is a likely cause of dust storms and could play an important role in understanding the climate and atmosphere of the red planet. Well, this is complete garbage. And actually, they show a picture. It's rather comical of the sun setting on Mars. And you know what the sun looks like when it's setting on Earth. It's as big as the full moon. On Mars, it looks like a little teeny dot going over the horizon. And so it's, I mean, to somehow imagine that this energy stores up in the atmosphere over a period of time seasonally, and then all of a sudden comes raging out all at one time. It contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. But never mind that this is being published then. It's called Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences. It's a research article. And, I mean, the bizarre nature. Now, these are peer-reviewed articles, so this had to go through some peer review. And as I say, just absolutely bizarre, you know, science where they don't account for the energy, for example. Where does the energy come? How is it stored up? How is it released all of a sudden? One day, all this energy just comes rushing out of nowhere and all of a sudden creates these massive dust storms. There are hurricanes that have been seen on the Martian surface that were photographed from Earth. That's how big the hurricane was on Mars. And, of course, on Earth, they talk about the hurricanes being caused by warm water, which is absolutely absurd. The hurricanes are another electrical effect because they're driven from the ionosphere. So it shows the bizarre state of science in the 1980s where they're mapping the surface of Venus. They get all done mapping one full year of orbiting Venus, and then they have a little bit of lifetime in the satellite, the Magellan probe. And so they start remapping the surface of Venus, and it's totally changed. Yet nobody will recognize that that would indicate that this is a young planet. Clearly, that indicates that the surface of Venus is highly volcanic, it's highly pliable, and it would be more like a like if you're making oatmeal in the morning. And the oatmeal, it goes in the water, and then it starts bubbling, and it sinks down, and that's a perfect example. I have another one that I showed a picture of on my webpage. It's called, I call it a milk boil. And so what you do is you take whole milk, and if you lived on a farm when you were young, they would take the whole milk from the cow and boil it on the stove. And as it would boil up, it would like bubble and ooze and then sink down in some places. And that's exactly like the surface of Pluto, the planet Pluto, where this is doing the same process. But Venus is a young planet that is just, it's bubbling volcanoes. They counted thousands and thousands of active volcanoes on the surface of Venus. So these are, it's not just oozing a bit, these are active volcanoes, and when they belch out gas, fills the atmosphere of Venus with sulfur acid and other very hostile chemicals, giving the atmosphere of Venus just a basically a very clouded atmosphere, where it's raining sulfuric acid onto the ground. Very hostile environment. And to imagine, some people even say that it would be Earth-like, that it was Earth-like, and all of a sudden this runaway greenhouse effect caused it to become the planet we see today. Absolute absurdities. But, standard science has no bounds when it comes to absurdities. So anyway, back to these 4 years, 1987 to 91, I'm going to talk about the just a whole series of topics. And also, during this time, I was in my very nice job in the telecommunications industry. Very high-paying, very, kept me as a person very well. And it also kept me hidden because it was a high-security job. It was, like, not publicized. I did take part in international conferences, like on the Ethernet, the 602 protocols. I was participated in those, but that was all private meetings, not something that would be publicized and identify me as a person working there. And then also I had my work with the MACOM. I had my own business selling MACOM telecommunications equipment and antennas. And what you'll notice is during this time, I had all of the things in place in my background for the Nazca Lines discovery, which came in the year 2015. But there it required my knowledge of atmospheric electricity, of antennas, antenna arrays, which is what the Nazca Lines complex is all about, and the different characteristics of antennas, the interferometer construction of antennas, and it took a while later for fractal antennas to come in. That was something that was not even invented until much later. But it took all of these technologies that I had to understand to solve the riddle of the Nazca Lines, which, like I say, came in 2015. But at this point in my career, I had pretty much all the pieces in place. But the other things that happened in 1989, the Ulysses probe was launched, which was circumsolar. It was actually, I believe, launched in 1990. So that came a bit later. But I just want to talk a little bit also about the Russian space program. The Russians never missed a beat. The Russians have been going into space since the early 1960s. They had shuttles. They had a big shuttle. They had the mini Cosmos shuttle that held three cosmonauts. And they had so much boost power on their rockets that they had excess fuel when they got up into orbit, so they started putting other things on their launches One of them being, it was a spy, basically, device where they could fly across the United States in different paths and take pictures and have and collect all of this data on the United States or any other country that they wanted, and then land these Cosmos shuttles. So they're little mini shuttles. I have a picture on my webpage. And the United States intelligence knew all about this, but they couldn't do anything about it, of course, because they didn't have the technology to counter it in any way. But so the Russian space program, and both the manned and unmanned space probes, were very active during the 1980s, late 1980s, and it still is. The United States, most people don't understand this, depended almost exclusively on Russian launches, especially for big military payloads. And Russia just charged a fee for all of the activity. The U.S. space shuttle program was a complete disaster. It would be 6 to 8 to 10 months between launches of the space shuttle, and they really accomplished very little. And then to bring this entire spacecraft back to Earth, which the people that really knew about the space shuttle called it the flying brick, because it was so heavy, and it took a tremendous amount of aerobraking to slow it down. So it was not what you would call a successful space program at all. It was a giant waste, and it took away from the manned space program, which was actually producing real information, but of course the real information was twisted. By the time it got through the NASA scientists, there was really nothing of value there. In this show, I'm going to skip around a bit, and I'm going to skip to a different topic here. This is the importance of man. Now, if you look at man, a very complex being, has a spirit that lives in the body, something that science does not recognize, of course. And it has, in terms of the matter in the universe, if you look at all of the matter in the stars, in the galaxies, in the quasars, in the planets, I mean, even the planet we're living on, the amount of, with even with a high population, what some people consider high, you know, 7 billion people, an extremely small amount of matter, carbon matter, etc., and you know, the nucleotides based on carbon and oxygen and hydrogen and nitrogen and some phosphates thrown in, and primarily water, a water-based, we're a big water balloon, basically. Our blood is 90-some% water. So if you take away the water, there's really not much left, calcium, etc., for the bones. But the point is, the living being, the person has feelings. So it's something that a rock or a star simply don't have. They don't have the ability to express or to change their environment. And so this whole issue of man, there are existentialists that say, oh, there's no meaning to life, etc. Well, that's a very bizarre thought, because life is a gift that is so more than amazing, because the universe would not be anything if it just existed. It's like the old question, does the tree make a noise when it falls in the woods and nobody's around? Well, of course it's going to make a noise, but can you prove that? Well, of course not. But it's the same issue. What if there was a universe with no intelligent life? It would be a pretty stark universe. It would just go on and, you know, things would happen. But there would be no ability for, say, the grand designer to have somebody turn around and just basically thank him. Thank you for this life, for this wonderful gift of life and of spirit and of recognition and of understanding the universe. And so it's important when you're a scientist to understand this simple fact. And 99.99999% of all scientists, and I would keep going with the nines there for a long time, I don't want to bore you, but yeah, vast majority of scientists don't understand the immense value there is in the human, what I might just call the human experience, because the absolute small amount of material that goes into man, but the entire universe is created for the benefit of man, because none of it would make any sense if it weren't for man to observe it and honor the creator, is basically what it comes down to, and also to recognize the huge importance of oneself. And I'm not talking in a narcissistic way, I'm just talking about in understanding that the great value that there is in human life, etc. And of course, the world is being run like a slave merchant ship by a bunch of crazy Captain Ahab moron leaders. But this brings another interesting topic. I was just recently contacted by a person who's a staunch creationist. Okay, and they believe that literally the Bible says on this day in history, the earth was created, then man was created, then woman was created from a rib, from Adam, etc. And so they're strict about this concept, but the question was, the Genesis, the tale of Genesis, where the human race is generated by God, and the tumultuous beginning. And so my answer was that if you understand that these are figurative, and in the sense, see now, here's the situation. You have these ancient people, they're trying to describe the beginning of the world, you know, and they're asking these basically intelligent questions. Where did things come from? And so because of the limited scope of man, the limited ability, because we see things with our senses, we have limited, you can only see the mountain over there, you can't see on the other side of it. For a long time, people living in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley thought that the firmament was held up by pillars that were up on top of these mountain ranges to the east and the west. And then one day, some guy walked up over the mountain, and he said, hey, there's sky over there, too. And, of course, they go back and tell the people, and I go, no, the firmament begins right there. We can see it. And so this is the development of man mentally and, in a sense, spiritually, to understand that their little world is much bigger than what they think. So back to my response to the person who is a staunch creationist. And this I'll include also the Colburn, which is a series of books that I received from the people who had been guarding these that were unchanged. You have to understand that when people look at creationism and the Bible, that the Bible that is here today was tremendously altered through the Middle Ages. And what they did is they took out all of the catastrophe information because they didn't understand what it was or what it meant, and they thought, well, this could not possibly be true, so they removed it. So the Bible that you see today is a very, it's almost unrecognizable from what the real Bible actually said and talked about. But the basic core issue of a violent beginning of man, and it's not really the beginning, it's just a phase where man lived through this, and the last one to happen was the Venus event, where Venus came near Earth, caused a serious pole shift of about 30 degrees, and mountain building and the changing of ocean shorelines, just a tremendous amount of upheaval, a mass extinction of animals and human beings, some of them partial extinctions, etc. So back to the idea of Genesis, yes, there is truth in Genesis, in, say, the recreation of Earth, etc. And but you have to understand the Bible that is there today has been completely altered from the real version that existed just a few thousand years ago. And so the creationist argument is a figurative, and any time you read history or you read books that were written by man, they are figurative, because the people were seeing the world through their eyes, through the lens that they had in those days. And then, of course, like I say, the Bible had been changed radically throughout history. And so the creationists, they're trying to put specific dates, etc. And there again, I don't put dates on things, because we simply don't have enough scientific information to put dates on it. But the story is corroborated that there was a violent and early beginning of man, that in terms of man's vision of the world, this is God's creation plan. In fact, violence is a part of nature. If you look at a forest fire, forest fires destroys the forest, and you think how terrible, this beautiful big forest was just destroyed by a fire. But what happens is the big full growth trees were blocking the light from the little trees, etc. And so after the fire goes through, the seeds in the ground maintain, they live through the fire, they start sprouting again, and you get a rebirth of the forest, starting from scratch, and then it'll eventually, maybe through thousands of years, build up to a full forest again. And this is nature's method of violence. So a comet coming through the solar system, a big comet nucleus that comes near a planet like Earth or Mars and does a tremendous amount of destruction, it's part of the system, it's part of the design. And it's not fun if you're going through that, but this is the way the design is. That's simply a scientific observation. Okay, so I would say that creationism is too literal, but it has a much closer, what would you call it, much closer theme than modern science, which says that, no, all this stuff, the Earth, everything was created 4.5 billion years ago and nothing has happened since. That's really wrong. I mean, that isn't even in the ballpark correct. Okay, so back to this time frame, 87 to 89, 91, in that time frame, I'm gainfully employed. I'm still traveling around going to the American Geophysical Union meetings, but there's a dearth in general in the scientific community, especially relating to space science. And the publications, the PhDs being given, all of that continues. But I just want to talk a little bit about my work in the telecommunications industry. This was a time of great change. This is when the digital world was taking over the whole world, the whole universe of telecommunications. The legacy IBM computer, the company I worked for, built IBM-compatible mainframe telecommunications computers. They were called FEPs, front-end processors. Very complex part of telecommunications in private networks. We built private networks for all the big government corporations, for oil companies, for banks, and worldwide. And these were private networks. We never had an issue with hacking. It didn't exist because we had private secure networks. And the internet was yet to come. There was a guy who is generally credited with inventing the internet. Timothy Berners Lee is his name. I believe he's from England, and generally credited with creating the HTTP structure. When you see a web page, it usually begins with http://. www, World Wide Web. He was instrumental in creating the very first www web page. And so all of the protocols that came into place, he had a hand in doing that. Prior to that, there was a thing called TCP/IP, which was called Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol. And that was the old method of doing exchanges on the internet, but it really was lacking. It wasn't a good tool. So Timothy came up with the HTTP, and it was done for CERN Labs, for a government database. And then it grew into basically the internet that we have today. So during this time period, the protocols, the transmission protocols, the HDSL. It's called the High Bitrate Digital Subscriber Line, and these were T1s, they were called. That's the industry buzz term for 1.544 megabit per second digital bidirectional telecommunication line. So we now, instead of having, in the old telecommunications world, you had a signal that went one way and data, and then you used the same line to return. And so the bidirectional conversation where the send and the receive could be operating at the same time came into place. And then the bundling of T1s of 1.544 megabit, all of these protocol standards came in and were solidified. And now, of course, like what I was saying, I was on the Ethernet committee, the 602. I represented our company at these meetings, international, to work out the protocols for. So when you take that Ethernet cable, that is, it looks like a fat telephone, old style telephone cable, and you plug that into your computer, and plug it into a modem, or you plug it between computer systems, etc. That standard, that's not only the wire in the connector, but also the telecommunications protocol that's going over those wires. That was all solidified during this time frame, and I happened to be part of that. The original form prior to this, back in the old IBM legacy days, with the IBM mainframe built in a computer room and all of the terminals, the dumb terminals, the 3270s they were called, and IBM. But what you would do is you'd hit a key on the keypad. It would send a signal to the IBM mainframe. The IBM mainframe would send back a signal and put a symbol on your screen. And so this went on, and then they finally realized, well, this is taking up a lot of bandwidth. It's taking up a lot of telecommunications. It's taking up a lot of CPU time on the mainframe. Why don't we just have these simple tasks done out on the terminal? And so all of a sudden you had smarter and smarter terminals. They put more memory, disk space, and intelligence in the terminals. And all of a sudden you have the personal computer where you could unplug it from the mainframe computer, do autonomous work, and then plug it in and then have a session with the mainframe. Eventually, the legacy, in fact, I knew a guy, his name was Rick Bourne. He's from Minneapolis, who became extremely wealthy, and he was simply a businessman. He was not a computer geek himself, but he hired the best talent around of software people who could convert the legacy systems, the old IBM systems, into the modern PC world. And the guy made an absolute fortune doing this because all the companies were getting rid of their old, very expensive IBM mainframe and going to distributed processing. It was a trend that happened in the late 1980s. And so these are trends. The digital camera started coming into place. Kodak did not see this. IBM did not see this. My company that I worked for did not see this. I went to the president of the company that I worked for, and I said, look, this migration towards distributed computing is coming in place. And we could have been Cisco. We should have been Cisco. My little company had all of the personnel, the training, the manufacturing. We manufactured our own digital chips, our own instruction sets, and we had the telecommunication protocols all completely under control because that's what we did. It was transitioning to personal computers, and then you had the internet, and then you had the ability to route by finding what are known as IP addresses. And so the whole masking issue of IP addresses, how do you, you put in a search on the internet and how do you get the message to the person you want to send to? And of course, this was part of the DARPA process too, the DARPA research, government research group, to have a web that all the government computers could plug into. And, of course, that was a terrible idea for intelligence and defense because it opened up the door to hacking. And so it was at that point also that the government made a decision that you could not have high-level encryption on personal computers. And so they started going in and requiring software companies and browsers. This is where the whole internet spying thing started, because the government went in and would not allow companies to sell true encryption. They prevented it. And it was the reason was the government wanted to see everything that was going on, and this opened the door for hacking. Okay, so then you also had Navigator, you had the Windows, you had various search engines coming into play, precursors to Google, etc., where you would go on and search for information. And then browsers, which you would type in a URL, it would go to that page and pull up the information. So this was the birth of the internet. And as I say, I was very much a part of all of this. Right now, the telecommunications protocols that are being used today are standard procedure. Let's just put it that way. When we were working with, say, T1 circuits for the first time, we were actually developing the protocols and things like the timing. When you have messages going on and the acknowledgments, and how do you get over a transmission line that maybe has some errors on it? How do you understand that the packet of errors you sent had errors, and how do you correct that with retransmissions, etc.? And how do you adjust the size of the packet? If you don't have any errors on your line, you can send great big packets. If you have a lot of error activity on your line, then you want to send short packets, so the probability of an error occurring in a given packet is small, and when there's an error that occurs, then you correct that. Otherwise, if you had very long packets on an error-prone line, you would be retransmitting everything and nothing would get through. So all of these protocols that became the basis for voice over IP, eventually Skype, and say WhatsApp, and all of these other transmission applications, the basis of that and how you adjust with, say, a dirty line, a line that has a lot of errors, all of those protocols and methods of dealing with this were put into place. At the same were used in outer space transmission, where you have a deep space program, platform like a Pioneer or a Voyager spacecraft, and they're, say, right next to Jupiter, where there's a tremendous amount of radio noise, and you have this little teeny spacecraft with a transmitter that's the size of a pack of cigarettes at very low power. How do you get that signal out of there? And it uses a very highly tuned oscillator, like a Marconi oscillator. So all of these techniques, and by the way, I used those same techniques in my senior in college research project. It was with Auger electrons in a vacuum chamber that went down to very low vacuum. But to get the signal out, we used a multi-channel analyzer, and also the same technique of having a tuned oscillator, which is sending the data. And then you lock in on that particular data, so if you have a noisy environment, you can pick the data out of that. So all of these techniques, which are literally standard procedure today in telecommunications, were being developed during that time, and we were perfecting them. My time in telecommunications actually goes back to the time when there was half duplex. In other words, a duplex line is one where there's transmission of data in both directions at the same time. Half duplex is where one side transmits and you're using the same physical line, and so one side transmits and then the other side transmits back. Now, it's interesting because back in those days, we were using what were called 9.6 or 19.2. These are bits per second, so those are kilobits, so that would be a 19,000.2 kilobits per second. And then they added the duplex part of it, the bidirectional, by adding lines. So you had to physically add another set of lines to get the return signal of grounding line and then the signaling line. So for duplex, you needed four lines. And there was a study done at Harvard University by mathematicians who calculated that the maximum data rate you could get onto a physical pair of twisted wires, that's like telephone wire, would be 19.2 kilobits per second. They calculated this, so everybody believed this study. And so all of a sudden, somebody comes along and they time division multiplexed, or I'm sorry, they frequency division multiplexed the line. And what they did is they put a signaling and then a filter and a signaling and a filtering on the and used different frequencies on the line to create the T1 circuit. So all of a sudden now you have a T1 speed, a 1544 megabits, 1.544 megabit per second on the same line that you used to have a 19.2 kilobit per second digital line. And that's because they frequency multiplexed in these little channels on the same line. Now all of a sudden you can get a T1. Now they got better and better at that. Now all of a sudden you're getting megabit, multiple megabit speeds on a digital line. And this is where DSL comes in. This is digital subscriber line to the house. And this is where fiber optics comes in. It's the same transmission protocol except with fiber optics. And the thing with fiber optics is you can get a light pulse and change it very quickly with light-emitting diodes, another invention that's a Nobel Prize-winning invention. The LEDs, the light-emitting diodes, you can turn them on and off very quickly. So now all of a sudden you have literally 100 megabit lines, or certainly 10 megabit lines, going to the home with fiber optics. I think there's average speed right now today in the year 2022 is around 40 megabit per second. I think that's the current standard for signaling for the home high-end fiber optics use. And this is very common now. Fiber to the home gives you almost instantaneous response on the internet. And this is what opens up the entire world for telecommunications. So all of this development was being done in the late 1980s to solidify these protocols, etc. And that's what I was involved in. And then, as I said, the people did not understand the business that was changing, that the personal computer, distributed computing, the internet, the power of the internet. By the way, I went to the president of the company that I was working for, and this was at a time when the space shuttle was active, and I said, hey, why don't we build a telecommunications processor, a little one that fits in the corner of the space shuttle, and it'll have access and telecommunications with the space shuttle. And I was like, no, we're not going to do that. What a stupid idea. And anyway, this is the joker that destroyed our company. And here was the situation. We're selling legacy IBM telecommunications processors. IBM mainframes are soon to be out of vogue, and any moron would have known this by knowing where the industry is going. And we were building smaller and smaller telecommunication processors to put out in the field, into offices, etc. The dumb terminals, the IBM 3270 terminals, were becoming obsolete. They were getting more intelligent terminals in place. Second source companies were putting in very much more, much better terminals in distributed. The PC was coming along. HP already had taken up the battles for PC position in that world. IBM was very late to the game and came in and purchased the technology from other companies, realizing finally that the legacy world was ending. And my company did not recognize it. And the other thing is that our salespeople were making huge amounts of money. And they literally lived in the computer center of our of their clients. And we were selling in all over the world, in Paris and New York and Washington State and every place. We had oil companies, banks, government offices, state government, federal government, foreign governments, etc., all were using these IBM legacy networks, which we were building private networks. And so the sales head of VP was jealous because the salesmen were making five times what he was making, and he was the president, or the what do you call the VP of sales. And his salespeople were making five times what he was making. So he goes into a meeting one day. He says, "We're raising your quotas and we're reducing your commissions." They all got up and they walked out. They went to work for IBM because they could sell and make their good commissions from IBM. So we lost our entire sales force in one afternoon because this stupid vice president that, you know, he basically ruined the company. And then this vice president goes, "Well, we're going to go out and we're going to hire the best young college graduates that we can find." So they go do that and try and replace these salesmen that had been in the computer centers all over the world, you know, babysitting these computer centers and making sure the customer had everything they needed, and replaces them with a bunch of kids that don't know anything. Well, the company started going out of business, the sales plummeted, and it took 3 years of every layoff. I was in the ninth layoff in this company. And in the meantime, it had been purchased by NCR. Later, NCR sold it to AT&T. So I actually worked in AT&T for a short period of time. But this company's, just due to poor management, went out of business. And so anyway, in 1990, I became gainfully unemployed, which started another whole very interesting segment of my life, because I started some businesses, and I'll be talking about them in future episodes. Okay, now to discuss something I've talked about extensively before, and that is the discovery of Planet X by Robert Harrington and the Naval Observatory. So it actually occurred during this time frame. The first actual photograph that he took where he saw movement was in 1989. So he went to New Zealand. It was, of course, the first trip, and he knew right where to look. This guy had been bird-dogging this Planet X thing for about 10 years now. And so he started these expeditions. He knew it was down south. He knew that Uranus and Neptune were being pulled down in their orbits. They already knew, and I read this article by Anderson from JPL, that they knew from the Pioneer spacecraft, 10 and 11, that were moving out of the solar system, that it really had to be down far in the solar system. It, 40 astronomical units was the limit, and so Pioneers would have detected it, but they didn't. It gave them more data. And so at this point, Robert Harrington knew exactly where to look. So he goes to New Zealand, which gives him a good view of the southern hemisphere, the celestial southern hemisphere, and he starts snapping photographs with his 8-inch astrograph. Now, an 8-inch astrograph is a camera, and a very high-resolution optical camera, and he's taking photographs of an area of the sky that really is not well studied. And so, but he's looking for something big, and that is a sufficient camera to actually capture something that is Earth size or bigger. Because now imagine if something is four Earth masses, which it turned out to be, then it that means four times the volume, basically. And so we're talking about a 1. What's the cube root of four? Is about 1.58, or let's say 1.6. And so it would be 1.6 times the diameter of Earth, which would be, you know, I guess setting side by side, it would be about, not well, one and a little more than 1.5 times the Earth's diameter. So physically, if you put Earth next to this object, it wouldn't be that big. compared to, say, Jupiter or something like that, but still a significant object. Okay, and this object allegedly was in the sky. Now, don't confuse it with Venus. Venus was a comet, a large comet, came through the solar system, ravaged Earth, but the Planet X object was something that ravaged Earth much earlier and may have been the cause of the Noah's Flood or some previous mass extinction event. But remember that when Hale-Bopp came up through the solar system, it was perpendicular to the plane of the planets, and it crossed about 1 million miles away from where Earth would have been if Earth were in that position in the solar system during that time. Okay, so anyway, it's very important that Harrington discovered the first major picture in 1989, and he goes, okay, there it is. They can see the movement enough, you know, that 1 month that he's down there, he sees enough movement, and he goes, okay, there it is. I see it, but I can't get enough data. I can't get more data until the following spring, which is 1990. So Harrington goes back down to New Zealand. He has discovered Planet X. He probably can see it with the companion because the companion is fairly large. Probably, I don't know if it would be the size of our moon or not, but it would be relatively large and visible. So he has enough data at this point to determine that this object, if you have an orbiting companion, then you can determine the mass of the central object. It's a simple astronomical equation. So he goes back down in 1990, spring, May, June time frame, to New Zealand, takes some more photographs. He comes back, and he doesn't have enough data yet. He needs 3 data points. He's only got 2 to have a good view of what the orbit is. So he goes back down, fully confident, in May of 1991, and he takes the final data points. He comes back. He realizes this is an object that's much bigger than Earth, about 3 to 4 Earth masses, and he can do the orbital calculation, and they determine that this thing is on a direct collision course with Earth within, you know, a certain amount of error, of course, but it's going to come very close to Earth. This is where the signal goes out to the CIA. The CIA comes in and shuts down NASA. And I witnessed this personally because, as you recall, I knew a lot of people at Los Alamos. They worked with JPL, Goddard Space Flight Center, etc. And so all of a sudden, things became weird. A lot of them quit. A lot of the older people took their retirement. And all I knew is that they had to sign documents. That's all that I knew at the time. I didn't know why. I didn't know that Harrington had discovered Planet X. This came out later, and it took me many years afterwards. And so they realized, but see, when they first discovered this, of course, the intelligence agencies picked up on it, and that's when George Bush Sr. left office, 1991. Billy Clinton, so-called, won the election to be president, but George Bush Sr. was still very involved in the presidency, picked Dan Golden out of the CIA to come in and run NASA. And I saw the changes there. And like I say, I didn't really know why at the time. But the secretaries could not talk. They went from, "Hi, Jim, how's it going? What are you doing today? Who do you want to talk to? What's going on?" They went from that to, "Hello, yes, just a minute." Totally 180-degree difference in the personnel, the way everything was handled. And then I just want to fast forward to 1995. A friend of mine called me up and he said, "Hey, did you hear about there's a new big comet that was discovered?" And he was talking about Hale-Bopp. And so I called up Goddard, and I could hear the secretary answered, and I could hear just screaming and pandemonium in the background. And I'm going, "What the heck's going on?" And she goes, "Hale-Bopp, it's huge. It's huge." And at the time, I thought, well, it's a huge story. But then I'm thinking, but, you know, comets occur all the time. Why is this a huge story? And what she was really saying is that Hale-Bopp was huge, like a planet. And it had just become a comet. It had just transformed from being this Planet X object, which the security companies, the intelligence agencies knew about, and turned into a massive comet, which, of course, verified my work. Then this began the whole thing. That same night, Courtney Brown gets a picture from Ali Hainau from the University of Hawaii showing the companion, a series of photos. He forwards them to Art Bell. Chuck Schrammick, a friend of mine, talk show host from Houston, takes a photo with his backyard, very good astronomical equipment from his backyard, sends it to Art Bell. Art Bell posts these. And then two nights later, there's a mass suicide in Los Angeles, supposedly of Heaven's Gate. And this whole thing just explodes. But in the meantime, from 1991, when Harrington confirmed this, Harrington had died. Tom Van Flandert, his trusted assistant, goes gray on this gray rock, not talking about Planet X at all, comes across and says there isn't any when he spent his whole career promoting the idea and getting Harrington to actually pushing Harrington to move on this, getting the contract with NASA to discover Planet X. And so anyway, for the whole history of this, I suggest you read my book, Planet X 2020, The Real History of Planet X. Planet X Update 2020, it's called. It's on my webpage. But at any rate, once again, my work is central to all of this because all of a sudden, something they believed was a planet is becoming a comet, and a big-time comet. So this is the thing that, you know, conclusively proves what Velikovsky was talking about, that comets, planets, you know, they're somehow related. And the electrical nature, etc., the planet, the discharge of the solar capacitor. And clearly by this time you could see that that object was not some kind of little ice ball. Clearly, the theoretical work that had to be promulgated through NASA and its public relations agencies, which were part of the Golden Era, the Dan Golden Era, is having these public relation agencies that filtered out the information, etc. Oh, my goodness, this was a time of complete insanity. Okay, I'm out of time for this week. Next week, I'll pick up the time frame following the 1990-91 time frame. But remember my webpage. These shows are brought to you commercial-free. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and the water filters, jmccwaterfilters.com, or use the short URL, mymr5.com. We'll get you right to the MR5 sales page for whole house water filters, unique products you will not find anyplace else. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.